Next up is Ken Demarest, who's going to talk about some wacky things that he had to do, which no human being should ever have to do, but are becoming necessary in our modern game development world. And he's going to segue from that into some more general statements about resource management. So let's welcome Ken Demarest.
Can everyone hear this okay? Yeah. All right, I'm loudmouthed anyway, so even if it's not working, you'll probably hear me just fine. So I've been around the industry for a while, left and did like corporate due diligence and strategy with a giant megacorp, and now I'm coming back, and you know, a lot of the problems, ironically enough, that I see you guys tackling are exactly the same problems that we were trying to tackle back in like 1991 on Ultima 7 or 1994 and 5 on BioForge. I think part of what's been happening is not everyone has sufficient investment to be able to really get their resource management pipeline to a quality level that makes it sustainable, right? So now we heard about Half-Life and Halo 2, which, by the way, I didn't know what they were doing before I sort of went through this thought experiment for the patching. You know, I think more and more of us are going to have to go that way for various reasons that I'm going to talk about. So this talk's really a thought experiment. You know, it started with John asking me what hard problems I'd heard about recently, and it turns out that patching with no local storage was a tough one. You know, on the face of it, it's don't do that. You know, you shouldn't have to. You know, and it turns out that at the time I thought maybe I might be the guy to work on it. I wasn't the guy to work on it. So I haven't actually done it. I've just thought through it and talked to some people who have done it. In this talk, I'm going to focus on the high concepts, not going to drill down into too many practical issues. I'm going to make some assumptions about a future that may not occur, and I'll tell you what my assumptions are. And the overall goal is I'd like to drive some discussion with the whole group, across the whole group, you know, thinking about where tool chains and resource chains in particular might go in the next generation, and also gather some current best practices relative to, you know, what those future improvements might be and where people think they're going to get in like one product generation. And maybe this talk about patching will give some perspective to console guys who won't necessarily have the depth of online experience that the PC that many PC guys have, and for the PC guys who are unused to having storage limitations. So I want to start out by just sort of getting a poll going to establish a couple baselines so I understand what you guys are thinking about. By a show of hands, who has ever delivered a patch to their game? What is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. So that's like probably half of us, right? So patch, we've got about 17 people. All right, who uses late linking of data? That is, at load time or at run time, only then do you perform the final link on a substantial portion of your data. Who does it today? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Also 17. All right, so about half. All right, who has edit and continue in their data path? That is, and even if it's not for all your data, that's fine. I mean, you change data somewhere, you hit a button, and the game auto-reloads it and continues running without a level reset. How many people have that?
Is that data assets or
tweaks? It's really data assets. It's not, I mean, it certainly could be just a single change of a single value, but I think most of us have that. You know, I'm really talking about a major asset like a new character, that kind of thing. How many people have that level of edit and continue? 1, 2, 3, 4. Only 5 people. Okay. So 5 on that. You know, this is a bit open-ended for a poll, but what are the key areas that cause, for the five who raise their hands, what are the key areas that cause level resets? Like, for example, you change the level and you have to regenerate the entire shadow map. You know, could you guys, the people who raise their hands, just shout out a couple of like the key things that cause level resets for you. Anything stateful?
Behavior, character behavior.
So AI. AI and behavior. Anything else?
Missing references.
Missing references. You want to capture those? So level resets, major state change, / AI. Missing references. Anyone else?
Physical setups. Like the physical system might be.
Like you've moved something around in the levels
the
so much.
And it's in a weird position and stuff like that.
Okay. All right. And how about invalidating edit and continue in general? Is this, and by that I mean, it's not a level reset, it's the whole thing. You've just got to give up on the level. You know, you've got to, restart the game. Is there, for the people who do have edit and continue, is there a, gee, I've just got to restart the game now data moment? Or do you support data reload, you know, more generally?
There's a related one, actually, which is some things you can't edit and continue because you don't want to go through the headache of the appropriate restart because it would be too hard.
True.
Right?
Although
so
we'll,
in my current project, we have these sets of collision volumes for these locomoting robots and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can change the visual mesh, but if you change the collision thing, it's just like too much of a pain.
Right.
So the question is, I guess, are there assets that you would like to edit and continue, but you just don't because they're too hard?
Animation data.
Okay, so animation data. All right, so whose products today support mods or plugins distributed over the net, by show of hands? Even if it's just downloadable content that you have generated that people can either buy or you're just given to them, by show of hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And who here's console only and really does not deliver on the PC at all? Oh, wow, so a bunch of people. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. All the console guys are sitting over there, and all the PC guys are sitting over here. Bride, groom. All right, so a lot of people are console only. Well, then there might be some relevance to what I'm about to say. Who knows? All right, so here's the situation. As I've seen it after talking to Xbox guys and PS guys and so forth, the next-gen consoles are going to be providing connectivity. DS, for example, even has it just wireless right out of the box. Sending data to the console games after the sale is going to enable new revenue opportunities. This is my way of convincing you that you're going to have to deal with it. If there's revenue, it's going to come to you. So patching, which of course should never happen in theory, content unlock, that is, when you ship a DVD, if you're, the game that the player's about to play fills half of that DVD, you know, your biz guys are going to say, well, the other half of that DVD has got to be filled with something, for God's sake, so that we can do a content unlock for $4.95 over the net, right? Because the margins on that stuff, when you don't have to go through your distributors, are fantastic. Content extension, more maps for Load Runner, right? Any small configuration of data that can open up new gameplay opportunities and do a lot of reuse of the DVD data. Community mods, it could be that there will be console mods that are actually built on the PC, right, using the PC tools, but then end up getting shipped to the console or shared. And then marketing intrusion, that is surveys, advertising, dynamic product placement. Yes, I have met a guy who is, in fact, brokering product placement into computer games. Upsell and cross-sell, right? Hey, buy the next version of this thing or buy this related thing. So all those are going to be real revenue opportunities. And as the next gen gets more and more online, you're going to almost certainly be dealing with them. Not everybody. Some people just ship a single-player game, and that'll be that. But, you know, the Xbox guys say, hey, you've got to at least be online aware. And if you're online aware, the financial opportunities will probably start pushing you toward this kind of a model. So the problem, of course, is that storage is likely to be limited. It'll never be as massive as PC storage. You know, the massively multiplayer online games, they are the patch kings. I bought City of Heroes the other day. I play the thing, you know, and when I start up, it says 892 meg, you know, patch loading. I'm serious. That's the size of the most recent one. And many of them are that big. But you're not going to have 892 megs on the console. You know, they're solving the problem with the sledgehammer, but you're not going to get to. So the current PS2 has no hard drive. You know, Microsoft's hard drive, one of their big cost problems was, my understanding is, they couldn't reduce the cost of the damn hard drive. They saw all the other components and how they were reducing in costs, and they couldn't actually drive the hard drive cost down, at least to their expectations, caused a financial difficulty for them. And so people are tending to shy away. And I think it's fair to say that we're seeing a trend toward memory cards. You know, you can look at the PS2 and you can probably project from there. So memory cards, not going to be the size of hard drives. It's a pretty fair bet storage is going to be limited. Any additional comments to that, by the way, from either the PlayStation or Xbox guys? Is that a fair assessment? Okay. So what do you do if you want to be able to get more content to the user? Well, you could require storage. That was tried with Final Fantasy. Didn't really fly. And even if you do require storage, you're not going to be the only app using it. You could send the data every time. So this is plausible, but you know it's kind of slow. If you think about it sort of more broadly, the online connection is just a remote hard drive. A remote hard drive with a really nasty access time, right? So in a way, you've got more bandwidth than storage, right? But currently on the PS2 today, about 60% of PS2 users that do have connectivity are using broadband. About 40%, though, are still using modem. And when I show you the numbers later about how many users this means overall, that's a lot of people who are still on modem. So sort of the inevitable conclusion is any data that you send should be as small as possible. Duh, right? So here's the reality check. North American PS2 install base is about 30 million people. There are 3.2 million connected users. So they've gotten to about 10% today, right? The estimations that I'm getting when I talk to people are it's unlikely to break about 30% connectivity in the near to midterm. It would be nice to think that everyone's just going to be connected with always-on connections, and you know that would certainly open up new market opportunities, but we're almost certainly not going to get that. Europe is still hamstrung because their communications infrastructure is often dominated by still essentially government-run organizations. They don't have... they're not cost-efficient. They're really, really not cost-efficient. If you have any thoughts of like going and taking over Europe's connectivity market with your fantastic game, forget it. I mean, you know, you're so used to thinking about, oh, well, I'm going to get half my sales in the U.S., I'm going to get half my sales in Europe. When you do online stuff, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to change anytime really, really soon. I've been hoping it would since 1995, and it's not changing. Japan, the uptake is a little bit less certain. Some numbers that I've seen are, you know, one of the largest PS games, PS2 games, has about 500,000 subscribers. Probably the net total is a little bit less than a million people. Korea, there will likely be uptake. Right now, they're all totally focused on MMOs. But it's not unreasonable to think that the consoles can probably coach some people over. You know, all the new PS2s, relating to the 3.2 million number, all the new PS2s have a network adapter built in. That's that new, really thin PS2. So, you know, even if we do get to just 30% of the 30 million in the U.S., it's still 9 million users. You know, and it's not just the next generation that's going to drive that. You know, the size of the largest PC game penetration is only maybe 8.2 million. That's the last number I saw for GTA, although someone here probably has better numbers than me. More than 8.2 million? 15 million? But nothing else has like really come close to that, right? Okay. $10 million for Half-Life today. What? 10? Okay. Yeah. So you're somewhere in the potential of the sales of the largest PC games. Although, frankly, those things have been unbelievably popular. You're not going to have to capture all 9 million users to have a healthy profit. You know, the MMO audience is only about 500,000. And I'm talking about the aggregate, all people who play MMOs. They're having a lot of time breaking past, and EA certainly has suffered a great deal from trying to break past that 500,000 number. But the MMOs are popular and profitable, quite profitable. The ones that have succeeded are profitable. So it's probably going to be a market that's worth going for. And assuming that the Xbox 2 leverages the current Microsoft Network zone and sort of Microsoft Passport phenomenon and that existing user base, we're almost certainly going to see big numbers there. We may see deeper penetration. We might see lower sales, just sort of my gut reaction to the way things are today. So it's going to be a viable profit center. Does anyone have any data, by the way, that would contradict that, because I'm very eager to hear it. This is a thought experiment for me. All right. So considering it as a patch problem, how do we keep the data transfer small? You don't have to think of it as a patch problem, but you've got to get the data there somehow. And certainly, patching up already existing stuff may yield enhanced functionality with a smaller data footprint. So today's code and data layout often resist efficient patch sizes. You know, patches traditionally, they insert, they delete, they move, and they add, right? Very simple set of things that the patch can do. You know, but executables are sort of classically one of the horrendous things that are difficult to patch because they have code fix-ups, right? You've got to rebase all your addresses the moment you do your link. And when you do that, and when you insert a module, you know, somewhere near the beginning, everything else from there on is rebased, and the patch turns into a nightmare. This is one of the reasons that the current MMO guys just blort a giant amount of data down to you. Data aggregation also, you know, for load times, we all slam our data together, and we create some kind of index into that data. Often, that index is just like code fix-ups. You know, there's some sort of a nasty index that points in, and if you add one byte of data in the beginning, all your fix-ups change, all the locations of your other data tend to move, so on and so forth. And sometimes there's internal linking, so problems. Maybe you've already solved those in-house, but maybe you haven't really thought about them yet because it hasn't been important to this kind of update. So the good news is there's a couple simple techniques that can ease the problems. I sort of went through the thought process of what those techniques were and then found out that Half-Life and Halo are actually doing some of those. Which is nice validation, but it's going to make me look like much less of a genius when I reveal them to you now. So the bad news is a lot of these techniques do imply slower load times. Let me back up. Some of these techniques might give you greater build efficiency, and I'll sort of do that link up later in the talk. So the bad news is a lot of the techniques imply slower loads. You know, if your resource management doesn't use a sort of build-like structure today, you might have to do some re-architecting. You know, if it lacks uniformity, you might have to do some re-architecting. But, you know, the systems aren't actually out yet, so if you start thinking about it now, you might have a while. So, code options. Obviously, you need to stop those fix-up problems. DLLs are sort of the big obvious way to do that. Now, I heard an anecdotal piece of information that Microsoft's recent TDRs resist having you ship dynamically linked code. Is there a comment that anyone could make on that? It seems to be saying, hey, don't do any patching. We don't like that on our console. Anything? No? So anecdotally, you know, that could present an obstacle. We'll just have to watch the situation. You know, personally, I've seen products ship essentially with DLLs, even in the face of that policy, so whatever. You know, another thing you could do is, instead of DLLs, you could just ship the OBJ files. It's crazy. Oh, by the way, this isn't the first crazy thing I'm going to say in these slides. I'm going to lay it on like crazy later on in order to create sort of a straw man high concept of what a resource tool chain might look like in the future. So you could just ship the OBJ files in some fashion, lengthen at runtime. Certainly with enough prep, a link actually could be fast enough in theory. And then, like, when you needed to change an OBJ, you would just send the OBJ. You know, in fact, if you take that to absurdity, every single function could be uniquely linked in its own file, right, when you ship the thing. Also, the final way to sort of deal with the fix-up problem is make sure you have a fixed predictable link order. So to extend the thought experiment, imagine an order retaining linker. That is, no matter, most linkers right now, they link in alphabetical order. You know, or they link in the order that you've stuck it into the makefile or in Visual Studio into the IDE list, right? So, but there could be an order retaining linker. And that means that it understands everything it's ever linked before, and anything new that you've added, it sticks at the end. It's just a theoretical construct. Doesn't exist today. Probably will never exist. Or, after you've shipped your product and you need to patch it, you start naming things DZ2 underscore my patch file, right, and take advantage of what's already there. Or you go in and tweak your makefile by hand, or whatever it might be. But, of course, that leads to some pretty nasty code techniques. DLLs are pretty much the most obvious way of dealing with it. The other thing you can do to increase patchability in code is put in some code hooks, like a plugin architecture or a mod architecture. For example, you make sure there's a hook in the main loop so that you can pull and change game state dynamically. You need a way to install anything that you ship, whether it's in a DLL or in some other form. During startup, it's got to get installed. You put hooks around your memory allocations. When you have root ancestors for your classes, right, you can muck with their constructors and destructors. You can do auto detection of DLLs, or in the case of remote systems, you just ask, hey, is there anything I need to care about? And kernel process insertion. We've all got mini kernels in our games, so you insert some sort of function, some sort of call into your kernel. To help you patch up the game and get it doing what you need it to do. And all of those are modular techniques that keep the amount of information you need to send about as small as it can reasonably be. Shipping the OBJ files would be probably even smaller than that. So, and all of that gets facilitated if you have a really compact game state that's very easy for your mods to pull and either tweak or react to. So, once again, to go off into the wide blue yonder, you could also do things like manual aspect orientation. How many people have actually read about aspect-oriented programming? Oh, that's more than I thought. It was about 25% of you. So, it's interesting. Probably worth going and reading about if you are thinking about plugin architectures. So, Here's the idea behind it, and it would be something that would increase patchability. You take your virtual method table, and normally you don't have any control over virtual method tables. So in this case, what you do is you say, hey, I would like to, before I call something in my VMT, I'd like to perform an operation. Or after I call something in the VMT, I'd like to fix up what just happened and perform an operation, a before or an after. So what you could do is you go patch your VMT, and instead of pointing to the main function, you point to a little stub. And the stub says, okay, now call the before underscore apply damage function, right? Then call the apply damage function. Now call the after underscore apply damage function. Now go and tweak my stack so it looks like all I did was call apply damage and return as if I just returned from apply damage, right? Now all of a sudden you've got the ability to overload any virtually callable function and sort of tweak it to your heart's content. It should be a language construct if you really want to do it. That's what aspect orientation talks about. If that sort of thing sounds a little intriguing, go Google it, and you'll find some interesting stuff. So those are some code options for keeping patch sizes really small through modularity. Data has troubles too. So here is, generally speaking, what we all put our data through. We all do it in different orders. We all do it to greater or lesser degrees. We all have our own little crazy proprietary game ways of doing it. You start out with your source data. You typically munge that down into a much smaller game-friendly data format. You generate some kind of derived data like from that, like shadow maps and so forth, right? Then you link the data so that you resolve all of its dependencies, so everything's pointing to other resources in an appropriate way. Then you compress it pretty often. You know, your texture maps might already be compressed by this point, but maybe your text isn't. Then you concatenate it all into a giant file so that you can have short load times. And then what often happens is those concatenations are there and then embedded into yet other larger concatenations, all of which is absolutely terrible for small patches. But, of course, the way we've all been pushed, because it's a necessity. You've got to do it. So the hotspots are order guarantees. Once your data is made game-friendly, you know, this is not for texture maps. This is more like for animations or doing extractions from Maya or Max files. You don't necessarily have order guarantees when that happens. Max might have saved in absolutely any order, and you don't know what it is. Some source data has the butterfly effect on the drive data. It's not necessarily going to be predictable. Drive data takes a long time to generate, and that means that it's going to be really large. Compression often crosses assets. For example, you glom all your text together and you just zip it. But then you can't change one piece of that text. Internal linkage lacks persistent references. You do your link, and then if you want to patch by changing, a face from a happy face to a frown face, your internal linkage makes it impossible, because you've fully resolved everything, makes it impossible for you to go and get rid of the happy face and relink those things that used to use that texture to a frown. And concatenated indices are like code fix-ups, like I mentioned before. And then when you embed, of course, it only makes the thing worse because your index problem is compounded. So what are your main data options? Well, the big ones are you want to model your data build on code principles so that you have nice atomic buildable items, right? You want to do dynamic linking of data at load or reload time. So you want to link as late as humanly possible. And then you want to concatenate using a relocatable sector-based approach. If you're familiar with how FAT32 works, that's pretty ironic. We all do FAT32 in our files, but FAT32 is also the native method used on the disk. So, like, if the operating system just let us look at that enough, we wouldn't have to go through the work of writing our own FAT32s with relocatable indices and a sector-based approach, right? Wouldn't it be nice if you could, tell FAT to order files for you? You know, more and more applications are, or even NTFS, I don't care. More and more applications are in the position of needing to load a really humongous amount of data, And they'd like to do it from a bunch of really atomic-related files. Wouldn't it be nice if you could actually get down to the sector level and tell the operating system, all these files are related, I would like you to concatenate them, I'm going to load them in a group. That's what you're doing already in your own file system, your own GLOM file system, whatever you call it. So then other data options. Modularity and predictable ordering in all your data. You may not have it today, but it's probably not terribly hard to achieve, and that would facilitate diffing. And then making compression optional, or making compression have borders that are the same as your data borders, right? So if you want to get rid of one piece of data, you haven't compressed across the border, making it impossible to extract. It'll decrease your compression efficiency, yes, but it will make it more patchable.
It wouldn't necessarily decrease your compression efficiency if you're going across a different type of data, though, would you? If you're going from text to graphics data,
Right. Yeah, that's true. I think you'll see the worst efficiency harm happen when you're going across all your text data and, is it worth it to compress the word arg, and ouch and oof, and make those your window? Or do you find some meta way of, defining your windows and then patch a non-atomic? That's one of the problems, of course. The moment you have to start patching a non-atomic amount for efficiency purposes, the code gets much more complicated. All right, so when you're sending data or code, datestamp resources make those atomic changes really clear. It also happens to, I think, make it a little bit more QA-able, because you should be able to identify exactly what changed. You want to, once you've got your atomic resource, you want to diff it and then compress it before the send. The network's just not that fast. The time it takes you to compress it as you stream it off the net is going to be lost in the delay time introduced by the net. You want to merge it at load time. Remember, you have no local storage. One large console manufacturer currently does this for its patching strategy. It actually, you know, if a patch exists, it actually does merge it to the code, you know, at load time. But this should happen for data as well, and only send it when it's game relevant. You know, if you can get away with letting the game load normally, let's say you're, for example, Tomb Raider, and you, you know, it's just too hard to find the key on level 45, and you'd like to do some tuning to keep your users happier and make sure more people play through to the end of the game. You know, well, wait until level 5 when the key is hard to find to actually ask the network to give you the key. It does assume, generally assumes, you know, always on connectivity, but you can certainly say, you know, if people are Googling the net for the solution, hey, be connected, you know, when this happens, and you'll get a fix for your problem. So, you know, the patching problem is sort of mildly relevant. It's pretty small in scope. And, you know, I think everyone in the room is pretty much going to just get, you know, what those issues are and how to deal with them. So I'd like to sort of broaden the discussion a little bit. Suppose that you never had to QA in anything and you didn't have to worry about load times. Now, you probably spend a lot of time managing your data so that you can get a decent load time. You know, if you never had to do it, things might be quite a bit different. Your end users could theoretically get build results just like your team does. Yes, I know MMOs appear to do this already. They release stuff that's just full of super bugs, and you know, they just patch it gradually. But this is the basis for the thought experiment. And the experiment is that, you know, a quality upload and a quality build can be seen as the exact same thing. You know, conceptually, the delivery of patches to customers or upgrades or whatever it might be, any value-adding thing, is no different than the delivery of build updates to your team members. Yes, of course, except for QA and load times, delivery infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. But conceptually, it's just the delivery of assets that have changed, hopefully been improved. So Half-Life 2, Halo 2, Oddworld, they all have facets of the data delivery techniques that I've talked about before, late linking probably being one of the most prevalent ones. You know, having trim resource management, for them, I believe, has led to faster builds. And it tends to prepare you for efficient online delivery as well. You know, so there's more than one reason to go in this direction. The mod community has had a lot of these techniques for years. Doug Church was telling me that Thief 1, you know, had the, you change something on disk and the game reloads it. You know, but a lot of projects, as our poll shows, you know, they still sort of let their build environment stray from the faith, and for often for very valid reasons, various reasons, legacy, you know, not enough time, whatever, not enough budget. So how might the techniques that I've been talking about for online delivery sort of point us toward a general data delivery nirvana and an improved build environment, right? That is, can TCP/IP distribution of code and data be unified across your target audiences, your team, and your players? You know, right now, what happens is the patch process is absolutely 100% different, you know, than your normal build process. I'm going to do the thought experiment that doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Believe me, I'm aware of the practical considerations, but I'm not being practical. So let's pick a few pathological cases. An artist in your company adds wrinkles to a character's forehead, and all the players playing it on the net see it immediately. The dev team and the community are making simultaneous changes to a level under construction, and they all see it at once and don't collide. Content rights, that is ownership, is a characteristic of both the development team and the players. That is, what content can be seen by you at all. For the players, that's what did I buy or not buy, right? As well as your rights to make changes. Well, all of the players out there have content read-only, while your dev team has read-write. And in fact, parts of your dev team may not have write privileges to certain kinds of data. You may want it that way for process reasons. So we're obviously heading over the edge into like a hypothetical future. Why stop now? Here comes a straw man for resource management. So latent impossibilities. Here they come. Imagine for a second that all of your tools that you, that generate data, derive data, cause data to be processed in any way in your tool chain are actually servers. And they offer their data and services via TCP/IP. Anything can connect to them, send them commands, ask them for data, right? In a way, this is sort of the .NET paradigm, but for many of us, it just won't be the .NET paradigm. So Maya, Max, and Photoshop, your facial animation tool, whatever it is, right? They all talk over a uniform format, SOAP or XML RPC or whatever. XML RPC is just a lighter weight version, untyped of SOAP, but simpler to implement. Imagine that your tools are capable of evincing their change deltas, right? I.e., what changed between the last time you used it and now, not just the entire data units. Charles was saying how huge his Maya save files were, and they're absolutely gigantic. What if he could just get deltas, right? Only what changed. And you get it via a perfectly uniform resource system with perfect pointer management, possibly built into the chip, if any of the Intel guys are still here. And the game displays instant results and supports multi-user simultaneous editing on essentially live levels. By the way, I'm very skeptical personally about multi-user simultaneous editing, but someone brought it up, and I think it's not invalid to think about it. Everything you do has late linking. Persistent symbolic links allow a database to edit and continue, and you've written all the robust code required. All code and data compilation is always distributed. Everything is always distributed across all machines in your company, and it's all cached so that if the thing has ever been created once, the whole system is smart enough to direct you to the machine that has that data, or it's always mirrored to you ad hoc. Data validation is so good that it's really not possible for one of your artists to build something so wrong that it can get on another human's machine. It'll go through the process, but the artist will learn about the problems without anyone else being harmed. And automated code unit testing makes this true for code as well. Each piece of code, you know, is tested by an automated layer through an automated process, not by a human, to do the best possible thing in not causing the game to crash horribly. So also, all your derived data is never required. Your shadow maps, for example, are not required. You go and change the level loads and it runs, and you don't have shadows. It's generated instead through a task, and it's then later loaded once it finds your game finds out that it's ready. And you have a just-in-time auto-concatenation of data, possibly by the game itself, that will group your data for the most efficient load times into however many gloms you need, including shared data gloms and so on and so forth, but it's done automatically. And if that's not already insane enough, let's go on to code validation. A bot plays through your levels before you see them, and it finds bugs before QA does. In fact, by the time your product goes into QA, you know, the bot has played the game quite a bit. You've just saved a ridiculous amount of money on your QA. Yeah, of course, I know that it's going to take a long time for your game to become mature enough for the bot to play it. I don't care. Not what I'm trying to talk about right now. All bugs are always fully repeatable, even sometimes across builds. That is, the execution path of your game is predictable. Every unpredictable thing that could be returned by a function call is made predictable and remembered, and it's played back. And when the replay solutions guys talk tomorrow, they'll... today, right, later today. They will let you know that they've actually... I wouldn't say conquered, but they have done a damn good job of addressing that problem and making it a reality. Code and scripting both link late. They're fast. They dynamically relink for reloads or edit and continue. The game never halts. Here's one that I find particularly insane. The game never halts. The code is so robust, it even saves game state across major recompiles. So I do a huge get. I recompile, and I start my game, and it takes up where it left off last time. That's crazy. All right. The publish to your team members and the publish to players only vary in the amount of QA. They're both done over TCP/IP sockets, you know, and their machine points to a server, and it just gets new information, and that's it. And it's just like the team members getting new data. It's just that you QA it more before a player gets to see it. In fact, player distribution is just a version control sync. All right. So there is my at least half crazy straw man. And the reason I'm bringing the straw man up is I'd like to open the floor to sort of a more general discussion, a guided discussion talking about resource management in the next gen, what people think they'd like to see. Obviously the straw man has flaws galore. I know that's true. I put the question up, is there anything in that straw man, though, that's actually fully undesirable? Let me sort of start by asking that question. Poke holes in it.
Could you click back to the slide of the straw man,
please? This is probably the more relevant one. Yes. Yes, absolutely. Do you have the camera? I'll tell you what. Will one of you guys do the microphone, and then will the other one write down what people are saying and take occasional pictures? You know, when each time you need to erase the board. Yeah. So clearly, the amount of development time is prohibitive, right? Mostly prohibitive, Casey. Right.
So,
yep.
It's just going to be extremely strict. But also, you're going to pay a big price for that, and it's not just in the time it takes to develop. Although, admittedly, the time it takes to develop is probably the most important.
Right. Yep. Well, but you do have just-in-time caching, right? on systems that do have local storage, your developer systems,
I'm talking about just, the fact that the code has to be written to not be everywhere it could possibly do what it was going to do. Mm-hmm. Now also has to have the ability to do something without that. And all of that checking, am I doing this thing or that thing or this thing, or do I have shadows or am I running without shadows? Do I have this? There's some kind of implications for that.
So I think you're saying for practicality, you're going to have to pick some core assumptions about what data must exist.
I guess you could write every time. I guess you could change it into development time by writing every time twice. Once where everything right. is there and once where nothing is there.
Where nothing is there. Yeah. Yeah.
We have a comment over here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So two things. Until recently, I was running the team that designed and built Xbox Live. And one of the things that we were worried about and, in fact, encountered was after a game had shipped, when it was time to issue an update to it, the team was no longer able to build the original code because they'd lost the compilers or the tools that were used in the process.
So I've never seen that happen before.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious to know how people are, or if people are maintaining their tool sets and their compilers after the fact and for how long. And then my second comment is the other piece that's missing is thinking about the security of the release.
Uh-huh.
You need to be paranoid to the point where you assume that someone's running a rogue DNS server that's redirecting clients to their machine, which is about to download a patch that installs a spammer on the Windows machine.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you verify those files? And we spent a lot of time on those two issues.
Right. And you don't have to do that for your dev team, but you do have to do that for release. But you do have to do it for QA. Right, so you are actually going to go through that process in house before it goes out of house.
First, I'd really like to know
so security.
How many people are maintaining the
tool sets
after the ship?
Actually, let me start with a different question. How many people archive their code after the ship? Okay. How many people archive it live so that you can actually continue to compile it for any duration after the ship? How many people do that for a full year? Okay, that's about half, by the way. About half.
I mean, part of the process is that part of the tools get checked in, that part of your tools get right, and then it's the way
Yeah.
Well, not only that, the Sony and the Microsoft libraries, in the case of consoles, because they rep, and you'll get incompatibility because we had to go back a rev on Xbox SDK because it changed and the game behaved differently.
Mm-hmm. And Apple used to pickle whole machines of that generation too.
Yeah.
So later
yeah.
The OS wouldn't be able to do stuff like that.
Yeah, the compiler, the OS, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. How many people do pickle the whole machine? Yeah, I recommend it, by the way. That's the way I've had the most success doing it. You'll never get that environment. But we pickle the whole machine and the server, right? Because like you're dependent on so many network services.
What version of the OS is that?
Right. Yep. Everything. The full environment.
Yeah, another comment on the derived data. It's not only the code path that gets duplicated, it also can be misleading for people looking at the art. If, you know, like for shadow maps and so on, you know, they may misjudge the quality of the level that was built if they don't have the derived data as well.
So they'd have to have indicators. Let's capture that. So they'd have to have, you would need indicators when you weren't seeing fully built data. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Add cost. So indicators for indicators of when data is final, and all you should add cost prohibitive just for completeness.
So I'm speaking for a friend of mine who's not here, who would like to be here probably, about how much of this, he's doing a project where this is beyond theory that he's actually doing it. Mm-hmm. He's doing a massively multiplayer game like you might see EverQuest or whatever, except that the people who create the game work remote over the internet.
Yep.
Hundreds of people, and the entire game works as you're describing. People go move trees around, and you actually see it on other people's machines in real time. The whole thing's published back and forth. The entire product is delivered that way. So that's you know, it's a cool concept, and you can actually design a whole product around it.
Yeah, interesting. Although I would argue that even in the absence of designing your entire product process around it, it still has value if you can only find the financial and political will to actually cause it to happen, Atma. Oh, cost prohibitive. Oh, and Casey's, I think, absolutely correct in saying you're not going to write everything twice, but you're going to have to write your resource.
Anything performance critical.
Right. You're going to have to write performance critical resource dependent code effectively twice. I think that's not a bad estimate. Amit?
Hey, this is not a direct negative, but this whole thing will further empower publishers to ship games that aren't done or suck or
yes.
Going to be fixed later.
Yes, absolutely right. The easier it is for them to patch, the more MMO style your game will go out. You know? Yeah, sure. So let's add empowers publishers to ship crap.
One comment to the thing that Casey mentioned about your code becoming too complicated. One thing you can do that's worked very well for us in the past is to have, for resources that you can't load, you just put in a dummy resource of that type. So you only have one path, it can be really optimized, but okay, you get a pink blob and you know that there's a model missing there, or you know, if it's a shadow, okay, fine, you bring in some stupid little texture that you use for all your missing shadows. So you know, it is a way to get around that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Clearly, there's a moment, you know, not too deep in the well of all things that could not be included. You're not going to have to go very deep before the thing just isn't going to run at all.
Yeah.
Right. You know, the thus and such function is absolutely missing. Oh, well, forget it. You know, no one's going to engineer around that. Yeah. But, you know, on a data level, it feels you have added continuing code, so that's pretty good. You know, on a data level, it feels like striving for edit and continue at the least is, you know, is what we're doing in the next generation. And full reloadability with a minimal number of level resets seems like something worth striving for.
So it seems like one thing that's happened as I won't I won't say we were anywhere close to the straw man, but as we've moved, taken steps in this direction, most of these things, having late linking, lots of systematic hooks, and having those things be visible to end users, make piracy, security, and hacking and cheating problems much harder, much less tractable.
Do you have a suggestion for an opinion on how you might try to tackle those?
We're trying to do the best we can with those things, but in some ways, like having a constant stream of updates helps with the piracy problem because it's less valuable to have a pirated version of the game than the one that's part of the constant stream of updates.
Right. Yep.
And having to go to a much less convenient source to get your updates every time it changes.
Yep.
And MMOs don't have the problem because they do tie you into a server side thing where you don't have the whole game, right? But hacking and cheating, I don't know. It's just gets easier the more systematically things are hooked together.
When it's easier for you, it's easier for them.
You're right.
Yeah. Actually, there's two things about that. One is one place to go look for that sort of thing is DRM. Those guys are developing techniques for encryption. In fact, to sort of extend the idea, what if you shipped a game that would not run on its own? And that, in fact, had to connect to your server in order to get some piece of data or some kind of crucial information to allow it to run at all. It could be that copy protection, DRM to a great extent, kind of is that in some cases, some applications of it. It could be that we see things start to trend that way. I'm kind of skeptical of that idea, but I think it's worth sort of knowing about. What is that? Right. Sure. Yeah. Right, but on console, you're not going to have enough penetration of connectivity to do it. Unless you are an online-only game, in which case, the guy's got to have his connection to play anyway, right? So,
to be allowed to do it.
That's right, yeah, to be allowed to.
This might sound like stating the obvious, but if you're updating code, you better not break the update mechanism.
Right, yes. So if you haven't thought about it before, the PC guys, like the guy writing this code, sweats in his bed every night, worrying that his nugget of download code is going to prove to be someday insufficient and going to fail to contact the server and get the crucial update that he's absolutely got to have. Which might mean, by the way, that there's an opportunity for you to buy something from a third party that's already fully debugged and tested and knows how to relaunch and patch itself. That's PC side, by the way. Patching itself is kind of,
It seems like
almost meaningless in the console low storage scenario.
It seems like the people who have the real hard patching problem is NASA, and that we are basically a bunch of jokers compared to them. And so it might be interesting to find out what set of things they do.
Do we have NASA here?
Just as an out of box.
Well, but the MMO guys, some of the MMO guys actually do it a little bit less clumsily. They're probably the first place to go looking for that self-patching core. They all have a self-patching core, by the way. To do those downloads in the back. No.
I had a question about one of your earlier slides where you were talking about the downloadable content. I know at least from a couple publishers I've dealt with, they basically, you've got on one side Microsoft really encouraging everybody to take advantage of Live, and from the publisher standpoint, at least the ones I'm dealing with, they're not seeing a huge benefit in doing it because they don't see that revenue stream from downloadable content. And I've had a really hard time convincing them that anything, Microsoft will state Mech Assault and a couple of the games have had ones for play, for pay. But it seems like to the publisher I'm talking about, it's a lot of work for no reward, and that they see it as you can do in the PC space where you release a new level, but you couldn't effectively really charge for it, and there's not really a success in that model. If there's ammunition out there that counteracts that, I'd like to hear it, because we're just basically, we like to do it and we even can do it, but we don't have publisher support. So.
Right. I do have something for that, but does anyone out there have experience?
When we designed our current engine, went for an entirely over-engineered approach initially, and not for this reason, but the idea that we had was that the engine is a resource, and the game is fully defined by the data file, which meant that we would be able to have a data file that was a racing game and a data file that was a fighting game, and we could even do a split screen, and we could, you know, load both of these at the same time if they fit in memory, and we could run both games sort of split screen. That was the pie in the sky idea that we had. And so we did explore the idea of loading code, linking it at runtime, and we also the way we structured our code, and it's still structured in this way, is that our code was set up, we refer to it as a client server architecture. Every sort of major game component, the animation system, the scripting system, the renderers are servers. And they all have clients, so they manage their own clients. And
over an interface that happens to be function calls, or are you actually like going all the way to the TCP level? Like, if you have servers and clients, they have connectivity.
There is no networking in this.
It's just function calls as connectivity.
It's just like what we call our things. And it's the actual in a typical game, you call your what we call servers in a particular order. You run your animation system, you run your scripting, you run your rendering, and et cetera. We didn't even have a fixed ordering for these. All the servers were in a tree hierarchy. The data that came from the file determined the creation of these and how they were linked together. And, you know, it was sort of a masturbatory fantasy in terms of over-engineering.
So is this, by the way.
And it was horrible. It was absolutely painful because it was impossible to debug this stuff because everything was data and you couldn't put a breakpoint anywhere because you didn't know how you would get there. So we have sort of gradually scaled this away and peeled all the abstractions away, and now everything is sort of hard-coded and the animation system always runs before this. But at least that's sort of a data point for other people to think about.
Don't go back, implement this, spend five times too much money and say, Ken told me to do this.
So we're going to have to start wrapping it up, but I want to get back to that publisher question and finish it off. Did we have something in the back about that? Yeah.
I want to do one more poll, too. This one real quick.
One example I know of a success on the business side is The Sims. They have a... You know, the model is extremely simple, which is that people can create models and other people can stick the models in the game extremely easily. And there's an active business of people creating content and consuming content, of course. Last I heard, it was over 25,000 subscribers on a monthly basis to just stuff, which, you know, is enough to bother. And plus, it, of course, as we look for a future where there's endless sequels and, you know, quarterly sequels possibly, or bi-yearly sequels in the case of The Sims, having that endless stream of stuff just keeps your market hot all the time. And that, I think, EA believes that's part of the reason why The Sims is an evergreen product. But it has to, I think, be a very good match between the product and the technology.
I think, you know, the question was originally, you know, are those revenue opportunities going to be recognized by the publishers? And so will you actually have to be pushed in this direction? Or will you be sort of more visionary than them and sort of be pushing up, you know, toward them? You know, it's just going to be a matter of time before the biz guys let go of that conservatism because they see other people making money when they do it, you know?
Well, the
and
question was really, are they making money? And I'm not seeing any data that they are. It's just, The Sims is different because it's PC.
I don't know. I respect Gabe Newell. And he's making some pretty big bets that stuff, you know, made by others, you know, and incremental updates, incremental downloads will be paid for. You know, I think it's just a matter of time. Once you get around your distributors, the money savings and the margins are really attractive, and I think we'll see them yield out even if you can't point to a lot of examples today. That's a matter of faith. That's just a matter of faith. Do we have time to do this real quick? Okay, we'll do it real fast. Who uses journaling or techniques to improve bug reproduction today? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Unit testing. Who uses it today? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30 people. That's a lot. Who expects to do a lot more of it in the future? Let me ask one more related question to that one, which is, who thinks that the cost of keeping unit tests current is actually worth the pain of having to go back? Like, you're writing two pieces of code. The unit test itself can even be buggy. But who thinks that the value delivered from unit testing makes unit testing fundamentally worth going through that extra expense? 40. So there's a lot of buy-in on that. That's more buy-in than I expected. I think we'd all like to do it more. Data point?
Of people who use unit testing, does anyone do test-driven development? Or does unit test first? Is anyone actively doing that?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So that's test-driven development. Okay, how many people are today focusing on techniques to decrease the pain of doing multi-threaded development and debugging today? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 people. This is multi-threading today.
What was the last one?
11. It's all right. So that was debugging today. How many people think it's going to be among their top three issues, the top three most important issues as they transition to the next generation? Yes. Everyone. Just say everyone. Put it in their top three. Who thinks it's the number one issue as you go into the next generation from a code development standpoint? Five people put it number one. All right. How many people have a fully generic layer for tweaking data values, like the Half-Life 2 one, where all your data values essentially get into pre-made menus where you can go and tweak pretty much anything in the game? And then you layer GUIs on top where necessary. How many people use that technique? 12 people. And who sees integration of third-party tools as a major issue in your next project? That is, integration is going to cost you a bunch of money, and you really think you're going to be going out and picking and choosing at least two, and probably more. Integration is a big part of your next product cycle. Eighteen people. I think we're out of time, so I should probably leave it there. But is there any other sort of, like, these are some of what I think the next big issues that we're all going to be wrestling with. Is there sort of a top of mind one real quick that anyone, you know, is looking at in their next generation? Online security? Okay, that's interesting. How many people have made any development progress toward quality online security? Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So only 10 people have done dev toward online security. Other top of mind? Do you all think that, like, going online is something that's just not going to be all that hard because you already have good sort of team familiarity with it?
That's an interesting question because
Because you think it would be secure enough.
Yeah.
That's interesting. On the PlayStation, I don't know if Mark's still in here. On the PlayStation side of things, are you expecting to have a full-blown security architecture to manage online security issues?
Some
sections, yes. Some sections, no. Okay. Half-blown security architecture. Okay. Well, I think I should wrap. Thank you all very much for your patience with my crazy...
All right, we're going to be doing lunch now. This is another sponsored lunch where Mark DeLora from Sony will come up and give a presentation. And I believe, I can't see through that door, but theoretically they'll bring in the food like right about now.